Welcome to Forums for a Future. The subject of the current series of podcasts is entitled Living in the Future Tense. This series is based on the proposition that the choices we make today will have irreversible consequences within our own lifetime. Thus, for those of us living in this, the postmodern era, our new reality is that we are living in the future tense. Today is tomorrow. In the previous era, the modern era, people lived in the present tense. They believed that they could have whatever they wanted now. They lived as if there was no tomorrow. However, the defining feature of living our life in the future tense is that we are currently taking to the limit every aspect of our economic, political, and social existence. The clearest example is the rapid exponential growth in world population over the past 100 years, which has exceeded the capacity of the planet to replace the energy used and to absorb the waste produced. But there are many other indications that we are living in exponential times, for which population growth can serve as a metaphor for the more general concept of taking it to the limit one more time. The political, economic, and social reality of meeting the limits will be the defining moments of the postmodern era. The time span is a 50-year interval encompassing the lifespan of the majority of people who are alive today. We must now start living in the future tense, for today is our tomorrow. Today's podcast, number 38, is on one more issue that we are taking to the limit. It is our inability to speak the truth in plain, simple English. As a reference point, consider the one item that is capturing current news and will dominate our internal politics dramatically for the next 2 years, leading up to the 2012 presidential election. That is the United States national debt of $14 trillion. But what does that number mean? How can one put $14 trillion into any kind of meaningful perspective? I found it useful to use my own home as an example. When I was 5 years old, my parents purchased our home for $5,000. 40 years later, I purchased a similar house for $50,000, and 10 years after that, I sold it for $150,000. That house is now worth $450,000. The issue is not about the size of the mortgage, but rather the capacity to pay for them. Is the new owner in the same position today as were my parents in 1941.
This is also the way to understand the national debt. As a nation, are we any better or worse off now than we were in 1941 and at other times in our history? And if so, why?
The appropriate information is not the absolute dollar amount of the debt, but rather the wisdom of incurring it and the capacity to carry it. The appropriate statistic is the ratio of debt to wealth. Over the history of the United States, this ratio varied considerably, depending on the external circumstances that we faced as a nation. Before 1981, every peak in the relative level of our national debt ratio was triggered by a major external event: the American Revolution, the Civil War, World War I and the Great Depression, followed by World War II. Each time, after the external situation was over, the nation significantly reduced its relative level of debt, not by eliminating it, but by decreasing the ratio of the debt to wealth so that it became affordable. In 1981, we actually had less relative debt than we did in 1941, before the start of World War II. But after 200 years, this historical cycle was abruptly interrupted, except for a brief period from 1996 to the year 2000. The relative debt has increased unbroken since 1981.
Starting in 1981, it was relative reductions in government revenue to pay the mortgage that caused the debt ratio to increase, not an expensive, catastrophic external event as before. During and after World War II, everyone pitched in to help support the war effort, first through savings bonds, rationing, recycling, and a frugal lifestyle, and later through endorsing a progressive income tax in which the highest marginal tax rate remained around 80% to 90%.
The revenue built our national infrastructure, generated jobs, created Medicare, and a widely shared level of middle-class prosperity, and it inspired belief in the great society. Our debt-to-wealth ratio returned to roughly what it was at the time of the American Revolution, even in the face of the Cold War. But instead of continuing the steady march toward eliminating the national debt, in 1981, under the influence of Ronald Reagan's presidency, we started a new uncharted economic policy based on a theory that the size and scope of that level of government involvement in our economy was bad for the nation and bad for the American people. As a result, the highest marginal tax rate was dramatically lowered under the assumption that providing additional income for the wealthiest and the deregulation of business activity by government would stimulate even greater economic growth. The theory was that the benefits would trickle down to the workers below, and there would be no need to cut government social programs because the additional wealth would provide the revenue to replace that lost through the reduction in taxes. We now know that the theory was wrong. The relative reduction in revenue resulted in a rapidly increasing national debt ratio. The money never trickled down, even though productivity went up due to new technologies and globalization. The economic gains were not shared. The wealthy got wealthier. In the period after World War II, the average CEO made about 50 times more money than his average employee. From 1981 to the end of this century, it increased from 500 to 900 times larger. The end of the Cold War reduced the need for defense spending, and a modest increase in the marginal tax rate added additional revenue. This provided a brief period of national prosperity and a decline in the relative national debt from 1996 to the year 2000, when all of this changed again. We returned to the economic policies of 1981 of additional tax cuts for the wealthy and further deregulation of corporate economic activities by the government, with the same results as before: a huge increase in the national debt-to-wealth ratio. First, these economic policies have resulted in deferred costs that will increase our future debt if economic globalization is not brought under stronger regulation to reduce environmental damage, to limit excessive profits, and to increase job and financial security. Secondly, they allowed financial institutions to take irresponsible risks with the wealth of the nation, requiring the 2008 financial bailout to become a public expense. These two financial burdens are the direct result of deregulations, and they are adding trillions of dollars to the national debt ratio. The proposed budget reductions in spending for general health and welfare would simply shift responsibility for this part of the national debt from the corporations and politicians responsible for it onto the American public. But the difficulty did not stop here. It was compounded by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We were not asked by the government, as we were in World War II, to pay more taxes, ration gasoline, and reduce our excesses. If we had been asked to make such sacrifices, we would have stood up as a nation and said, no way. Instead, we were told to go shopping. As a result of the economic policies introduced in 1981, we have ended up with a greater consolidation of wealth and power by the wealthy. The magnitude of this transfer of wealth from the poorest to the richest is measured by a statistic known as the Gini coefficient. For an economy to be healthy, the Gini coefficient needs to be between decimal point 25 and decimal point 4. When the disparity of income between the rich and the poor is below decimal point 25, the incentive for hard work and extra initiative is reduced. However, when the coefficient is larger than 0.4, the larger discrepancies of wealth and income results in corruption and economic inefficiencies. The wealthy can then use their economic position to buy and control the political process. Paid lobbyists and campaign contributions distort the function of government from serving the interests of the general welfare to providing the means for vested interests to achieve an even greater accumulation of personal wealth. Since 1981, there has been a steady increase in wealth and income disparity in the United States. We are becoming a nation of many people living near the poverty line, while those at the top are getting richer. This growing inequality is a direct result of deregulation, tax cuts for the wealthy, and the systematic reduction of the maximum marginal tax rate. This has had an impact on the American way of life through a significant reduction in the size and the political influence of the middle class, the average American. Yet, the solutions being proposed in Washington to deal with the expanding national debt are to cut the entitlement programs, such as Medicare and Social Security, and to defer other social programs, such as universal health care, because we cannot afford them, while treating as untouchable the tax cuts, the deferred war expenses, and the deregulations which are actually responsible for the national debt. It was the pre-1981 economic policies that provided both the vision and the means for a truly great society. The reversal of that philosophy to experiment with the new, untested economic theory has been a failure. However, to actually propose an even more severe form of that theory as the way to address the current national debt is more than irrational. It is an invitation to end the American way of life for the majority of U.S. citizens. It is like bleeding the dying to restore health. We abandon it in medicine, and we need to abandon it in economics. Our nation is our home. We need to be able to afford to live in our country, no less than in our houses. We must pay for our national mortgage, and we must not allow the already wealthy to foreclose on 70 years of human social progress, from when my parents were able to afford to buy their first house in 1941, of our government providing a safe and secure future for its own citizens. We need to increase the highest marginal tax rate, end the tax cuts for the wealthy, restore government regulation of corporate and global economic practices, which have allowed the rich to get richer and made the poor poorer, and put to an end to needless wars and to start paying for them now. Our choices are that simple.
We do not want the final refrain of our era to read, "We are taking it to the limit, one last time."